Okay, by this insistence, we'll start. Okay. I need to be mindful of the feedback, as always. First, we'll begin with our Gujra in the Theravada tradition. I mean, given that this entire event is about a book that celebrates the non-sectarian fundamental character of Buddhism, I think it's fitting that we practice the Gujra in more than one tradition. So first, if we may invite Bhante to lead us in the Gujra in the Theravada tradition, so the Namotasa, and I think many of us are familiar with that. So if we may invite Venerable first.
So
Bhante Maharaj, now lead us.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. All right, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you, Bhante. So we will now begin with an address by Bhante Gamaratna. Yes. So he'll be giving us a short address about the book and the significance of it in the overall Buddhist tradition. So
Venerable children, venerable sirs, sisters and brothers, first of all I would like to thank organizers of this occasion, especially to Bhumiksa Temple also, for the invitation to come and give a short talk. I was given a topic, Four Immeasurables. Before I come to the topic, I would like to say few words related to the subject of this book, Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, written by our Venerable Chodron. Firstly, I have to say I am sorry, I could not get the time to read. I was given the book day before yesterday, then I had many things to attend, so I could not read, but I just turn here and there. So I am not going to say something very serious about the book. Anyway, I know Venerable Chodron for many, many years, because when she was staying in Singapore, we had a very close link. She used to give talks at Buddhist library. She was a regular speaker, and I still can remember she had written an article to Mandala magazine. Mandala magazine was published by Buddha Dhamma Mandala Society. She had written an article for that. And she mentioned about three traditions and her relationship or link with three traditions also. In that article, she mentioned about other traditions. She belonged to Vajrayana tradition. I think I am right. Then she had mentioned about other traditions, Theravada, Mahayana and Mahayana also. And mentioned there, she was able to have even closer relationship, even a closer relationship with other traditions. Not that she didn't have closer relationship with her own tradition, but she mentioned there she had very close relationship with other Buddhist traditions, Theravada and Mahayana, and known to many teachers of other traditions. And she worked very closely with them, she managed to work very well with them. That's what she mentioned there. So we can, I don't surprise to see she has written this book after quite a number of years. I think she is one of the best person to write something on this subject about three traditions. It is not something which is easy. Even writing something or a book about one tradition is not easy. Our Buddhist traditions are very vast. These traditions have grown, developed for many, many years, for centuries. So, writing something about three traditions is a very difficult task, but I know she is one of the most capable persons to do it, because to write a book about three traditions, writer has to be non-biased person. Writer must have very close relationship with three traditions. So she is a person who has all those qualities. So I think this should be a very good book. I turn a bit. So those who want to know about three Buddhist traditions, this will be very useful. We have a kind of weakness, we Buddhists. If we are attached to Theravada tradition, we do not want to know much about Mahayana tradition or Vajrayana tradition. We stick to Theravada tradition and try to criticize by looking at some of rites and rituals or some of the practices, without knowing much or without knowing anything about other traditions, we like to criticize. Then other traditions, the people belong to other traditions also have the same problem. Some people are belong to Mahayana tradition. They actually sometimes do not know much about their own tradition also, but very clever to criticize traditions of other people, other Buddhist traditions. Then Vajrayana, I am not there to say anything about that. I think Venerable children know. Some may have some criticism. I think criticism is okay if it is constructive, but without knowing about other traditions, there are some people, they say their tradition is the only good tradition or best tradition, greater tradition, and critical about other traditions. We have this weakness, but still I can say Buddhists are better than many other religious traditions. We are good for criticism, but we don't fight. We don't quarrel, we don't go to wars to protect our own tradition, which is very negative. The Buddha used a word for this, that means protecting own tradition by being madly attached to it. The Buddha said Ditti Paramasa, Pali term. Ditti is view. Paramasa is, I don't know any other English word to translate it, madly attached. If you are madly attached to your own tradition, you won't be able to understand the beauty of other traditions. So you will miss a lot of beautiful things. So the Buddha criticized that way of having a view is as a very negative view. Thinking own tradition is alone right or good, other traditions are wrong. We can have criticism, as I mentioned earlier, but we should not attach to any traditions in a mad way. So we Buddhists generally can say not madly attached to their traditions, so we have no quarrel, we can work together, we have good cooperation. That is the beauty of Buddhist traditions. It is a very beautiful thing. So now, good thing is this book has published, you will have a good understanding about this. Instead of talking about traditions without knowing much, good to have a good understanding. I think this book will give a very good understanding about three traditions, because I have great confidence of the author. She is capable of talking and writing about these three traditions. Before I come to my topic, I would like to say few problems with traditions also. They are very simple ones. A monk, he is also a Theravada monk, but within Theravada also we have different minor traditions. So one Theravada monk came to Buddhist library. He was introduced to me by his teacher. His teacher is very well known in Singapore, used to come and give talks. And my friend also, because of friendship, he introduced his disciple to Buddhist library when that disciple wanted to come to Singapore. Then he came, I prepared the accommodation, stayed with me. It was an evening. Next day, that means next morning, I prepared breakfast. Generally, I stay alone. For breakfast, I don't bother people. Whatever possible, I prepare and take my breakfast. So this monk was around. I prepared breakfast for myself and for that monk. Then everything was prepared on the table. I invited him. He came and sat with me. When we were about to take our breakfast, he refused to take the breakfast. Then he said, "Bhante, I cannot take this breakfast." I was very, in a way, very shocked. I asked, "What is wrong with the breakfast?" He said, no. "Breakfast was prepared by you and given by you. So you are a very senior monk. I cannot take breakfast except when a senior monk offer a breakfast." So I had no choice but to call somebody else. Fortunately, at that time, our treasurer was staying quite near to the library, about 5 minutes, 6 minutes of walk from her place to the library. So I called quickly. This was around 7 o'clock. She had not left for work, so she came. Her husband drove quickly. They rushed. Then I told what had happened. So they offered breakfast. After that, he had his breakfast. These are some minor things related to some traditions. I think sometimes this can be a problem. I don't bother about this kind of things. But when we stick to a tradition very, very closely and without much understanding, there can be that kind of problems. Then, in our Theravada tradition, I do not know much about Mahayana or Vajrayana tradition. Generally, especially forest monks do not handle money, but some forest monks, they handle checks. So even some forest monks or Theravada monks who do not handle money have checkbooks also, can sign checks. I can remember I was in a temple, also in Singapore. That was my first temple, about 45 years ago. The monk did not handle money. Of course, he held a checkbook, and he traveled. He went world tour, carried a lot of traveler's checks. That time people used traveler's checks, now hardly use. But anyway, he did not handle money, touch money. So he got a younger monk to travel with him to handle money. So can you see the logic? I don't handle money, I get a young monk to travel with me to handle money. I don't break the precept, but not to break my precepts, I make another monk breaking precepts. We have some problems with traditions if we are attached to them ignorantly. So I have so many stories like that. If I am going to tell these things, I may not be able to talk based on my topic. So so now I would like to come to my topic. Four immeasurables. In Pali, we use words Brahma Vihara for immeasurables. For immeasurables, we use the word Brahma Vihara. Brahma is supreme, greatest, highest, noble. There are many meanings. The Pali term Brahma Vihara. So, four sublime states. Four immeasurables can call as four sublime states also. In Theravada tradition, we have given a very important place for four immeasurables. The word immeasurables also gives a kind of understanding. Cannot measure the value of these four qualities. What are the four qualities? Metta, or love, karuna, or compassion, then mudita, or the translation given by many people is sympathetic joy. I am not so happy with that translation. It doesn't give any meaning to me when you use the word. The Pali term is mudita, sympathetic joy. I can say, later I will explain it with a bit details. What I can say about mudita is, it is the quality which we should develop to appreciate progress of other people. Quality against jealousy. In this world, we live with many people. We can see many people are progressing. Some people are progressing faster than us. Sometimes we are not progressing. Our progress is decreasing. But we can see other people are progressing. So, we need a very great quality to see this without having jealousy. That quality is called upekkha, no, mudita. Sympathetic, not sympathetic joy, mudita. Appreciation of other people's progress. Not only oneself progress. Then the third quality is upekkha. We have translation equanimity, that is not so bad. Equanimity, I like to use the word the wisdom. Equanimity is very close to wisdom. Maturity. A better word is maturity for my understanding. A person who can practice equanimity or upekkha should be a very matured person. Not in age. Person can be very young, yet he can be a matured person in certain ways. When he face certain situations, certain problems, negative experiences, if the person can stand firmly without collapsing, without having negative thoughts, such a person is a matured person. But when we talk about the maturity or about a matured person, highest matured person is the Buddha. I call Buddhahood is the highest maturity. So upekkha is the quality, upekkha is very closely linked with enlightenment. Only an enlightened being can have highest maturity. But it doesn't mean we cannot have it. We can have it, although it doesn't go to that level. We can have the maturity. To have maturity, we need wisdom. Without wisdom, cannot practice the maturity. So these are the four immeasurables. In Sri Lanka, I don't know whether Sri Lanka is my country or anything, because I have lived in Singapore for about 44 years, in Sri Lanka only about 29 years. So now I am in a very difficult situation. To call Sri Lanka is my country or Singapore is my country. But anyway, state of law of this country may not allow me to say I am this country is mine. Anyway, in Sri Lanka is a Theravada country. When we talk about Theravada country, we mention very proudly about Sri Lanka. Theravada. Sri Lanka is a Theravada country. We have pure Buddhism. The word pure Buddhism attribute to a country is not a very good thing. That's my understanding. In any country, pure Buddhism can exist, but it exists within people's heart. Not really with traditions. Pure Buddhism and tradition, these two are two different things. So we say Sri Lanka is a pure Buddhist country. In Sri Lanka, people, especially monks, always talk about four immeasurables. Especially when we go to give sermons, memorial sermons, if the deceased is a father or a mother, we talk about these four immeasurables and attribute these four immeasurables to them, to mother, to father. We say, in Pali there are a few words, when we say that, we use those words, Brahmati Mata Pitaru. Mata is mother, Pita is father. Brahma is supreme. I'm not talking about supreme God, but these words came out in Indian society. The Hindu God, the supreme Hindu God is Brahma. When they wanted to talk about something which is very supreme, highest, they used the word Brahma. So Brahmati Mata Pitaro means father and mother are supreme. Like Brahma, they are supreme. So in Buddhism, they are given a very high place, greatest place. In Theravada tradition, they were given highest place, calling them supreme beings. And sometimes we compare them to the Buddha also, only in one aspect. If you want to respect the Buddha, if the temple is very far away, if you have no time to go, always we say no time, huh? That is like a fashion also. We are always busy, no time to go to Buddhist centers or Buddhist temples. But you have to understand the advantage of going to Buddhist centers. I'm not going to talk about that. So you can have the Buddha at home. Your mother is a Buddha, your father is a Buddha, because they have those four supreme qualities. You can pay respect, you can look after your mother, you can attend to your mother, you can attend to your father, look after them, respect them. Then, not going to temple or Buddhist center is not so important. Not going to temple is not a serious problem, because you have your father and mother at home, they are like the Buddha. Because they have these four qualities towards children. They are the only people can have these four qualities up to a higher level towards on children. So in that sense, they are supreme, they are very great. But very sad and negative thing happened. Although we compare parents to Buddha, although we say parents have supreme qualities or immeasurables towards children and they are very great, a very sad thing happened in Sri Lanka. I thought it may not come out in Singapore papers, and it may not publish in English papers, huh? Then many people cannot know. Anyway, I would like to mention about that. A daughter, that is the biggest surprise. Daughter put her own father in a dog's cage. She had two dogs. She brought out two dogs from the cage and put the father in and locked. The neighbors came to know about that. You know, in Sri Lanka, neighbors are very busy bodies. In Singapore, people don't bother what is happening with the neighbor. We are belong to a different culture. But in Sri Lanka, you can't do anything secretly. Neighbors know everything. So neighbors came to know about that, complained to the police. Police went there, released the father and arrested the daughter. So we always talk, father and mother are just like the Buddha to us. They have four immeasurables, they are supreme. But in a country like that also, these things can happen. So it is a very sad thing. But I would like to direct your attention here towards something different. Many people talk like cursing to that young lady. Some even went to the house and scolded her, used very abusive words. But I think I'm coming to metta, love. If we practice true metta, we can see she also needs our sympathy. Why she became like that? Why her mentality become so low? Own father, putting own father in a dog's cage. When people questioned, she said, for her convenience. You see, the excuse is terrible. Because father was suffering from dementia, so difficult to look after, made the house dirty, so she found a solution. But it is a terrible solution. But she also need some metta from us. We cannot, this is extremely disheartening incident, but we cannot have anger, grudge, or hatred towards her. If we have that, we are no better than her. But naturally, we may have such thoughts, but we have to be very careful. Metta is a quality. Love, it is not ordinary love. Ordinary love can change to hatred very easily. Ordinary love and hatred, these two are two sides of the same stick. That's what we usually say. But metta, when we translate the word metta, Pali term, as love, it is totally different. It cannot change to that. If we are practicing metta, we have to practice metta or love towards this kind of people also. We must see why it happened to her, why she had such a low mentality. There must be reasons, and we must sympathize with her also. So that is called metta. When we talk about the metta, or first immeasurable, we say universal love, universal benevolence. We use this type of words. The translations are okay. But metta is love. In the real sense of metta, when we use the word love, it is very different. We still have to learn. Love without attachment. I think she will agree with me. Love without attachment. The problem is, nobody knows how to love without attachment. Everybody talk about love. Everybody is used to have love with attachment. When we tell this to people, they always think we have our children. They are very lovable. We have our grandchildren. They are very lovable. How to love them without attachment? But that is metta. Metta, the quality, we cannot say we are practicing metta if we have attachment. Attachment, with attachment, if we love others, even ourselves with attachment, we will end up with dukkha or discomfort or suffering. So metta, by practicing metta, it won't happen. So that is a thought which should be practiced with selfless interest. But I think I may have taken more time already.
That's
okay. So I don't think I can go for details. If you want details during the discussion, you can ask. Then the next immeasurable quality, karuna, translation, we can find the translation as empathy and compassion. We can use the word empathy and compassion also. But I don't like to use the word sympathy. Do you know why? I don't want anybody's sympathy towards me. Even if I am in a very tragic situation, difficult situation, I don't want anybody to have sympathy towards me. I feel sympathy is not really good. I don't say bad, not really good. Maybe because of my pride, I don't want anybody's sympathy towards me. Empathy, the word is better. Then compassion is the common translation. The empathy or compassion can be directed at five levels of discomfort. When people have dukkha or discomfort, at five levels we can direct empathy. One is compassion for those who are worrying or repenting for their misdeeds. We encounter with people, they repent, they worry about their misdeeds. So they deserve our compassion. We can direct our compassion towards them. Two is for those who have lost what they possess. Some persons through death of beloved ones, they are going through a difficult period. They deserve compassion. Compassion should arise in such occasions. Then things through theft, people lost things. Natural disasters like tsunami, the well-known disaster. Singaporeans are very compassionate people. I must say it honestly. I can never forget the way many Singaporeans acted when they heard about tsunami tragic. They worked so hard to do something to help people in other countries, not their relatives, not their friends. They have never seen, they had never seen them. They had no wish to see them, but they did a lot of things. So directing compassion towards such people who have faced disasters. So this is the second direction. The third direction, for those who have lost their self-identity, loss of position in society, suffering from identity complex, loss of position in the society is quite a common thing. Some people have very good name, many followers. Even some religious leaders also face this problem. They are like heroes, many people worship, but due to some reason, suddenly they will lose position, even may have to go to the jail. We cannot be happy, although they may be belong to other traditions, other religions, but we cannot be happy about that. They also deserve some compassion. Why did they become like that? We had to think in that way and develop compassion. Then the fifth direction, for others less privileged beings and suppressed people. Some people suffer a lot as a result of having less privileges. Some people suffer a lot as a result of suppression. Sometimes we cannot do much for them. Even then, they really deserve our compassion. If it is possible, we need to help them. Then I, third immeasurable, mudita, I have mentioned about that, so I try to avoid it. Then the mudita, third one, I try to avoid. Then the upekkha, also I have spoken about that. Upekkha is helpful for us to overcome our emotional reaction towards situations. When things are going wrong in our life, things can go wrong anytime. How clever we are also. We can be very clever. We may do things very well. We can be very successful in every thing in our life, every directions in our life. It doesn't mean we can have a guarantee about doing well all the time. Sometimes things can go wrong. So when things go wrong, our problem is we react towards them emotionally. Emotional reaction is very difficult to avoid, inevitable. Even that, reacting to such situations emotionally is not positive. We cannot see, we cannot see the situation clearly. We cannot find solutions, right solutions, when we react emotionally. Instead of reacting, we must respond to such situations. We must act responsible way, then we will be able to find solutions. So upekkha, that's why I said upekkha is upekkha can call as wisdom also. Wisdom arises when we do not act towards situations emotionally. If we act emotionally, ignorance will arise. So these are the things I wanted to say about four immeasurables. Thank you for listening. I hope you all will be able to practice four immeasurables. This is one of the most practical aspect of Buddhism, Buddhist teaching. If you can practice these four, you can go up to the enlightenment. These are so great, very great qualities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ajay. And now we would like to invite Venerable Penchotrin to lead us in the puja in the Vajrayana tradition. We will be showing the slides so everyone can follow through, hopefully in English. And we will invite Venerable, of course, for her Dhamma sharing afterwards.
I take refuge until I am awakened. The Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, by the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So before beginning, I want to thank Ramati so much for coming and joining the panel, and thank the organizers, and thank the sponsors who are sponsoring the book for free distribution. Very kind of all of them. This book got written. It wasn't exactly my idea. I was working on a larger book for His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and in the middle of working on that, he said, we need to add material from other traditions to make this book unique. And then as time went on, it really came out that he wanted a separate book about what we came to call the Sanskrit tradition and the Pali tradition. So again, His Holiness's reason for wanting this book is he said that he has a much closer relationship with people from other religions than he does with Buddhists from other traditions. And he didn't think that situation was right. He wanted to really have better relationships with other Buddhist traditions together. And so he wanted the book written in that way. So instead of writing the book on a very superficial level, like, yes, all Buddhists bow to the Buddha, and we all make offerings, and we all meditate, you know, not talking about things like that that are very evident, but really going into the book in terms of the doctrine and what the people in the different traditions believe. And this was something that I had to do a lot of research. My coming to Singapore initially was something that opened me to all the other Buddhist traditions. But in preparing the book, I had to really learn much more about the Theravada tradition, we call the Pali tradition, and also about the various other Mahayana traditions. By the way, Vajrayana is a Mahayana tradition. It's not separate. It's a type of Mahayana tradition. And Tibetan Buddhism is more than Vajrayana. And Vajrayana is also practiced in Japan. So just to clarify the use of the terms a little bit. So in learning about the other traditions, it was just fascinating for me because I had known before about a little bit about the kinds of stereotypes that people from one tradition have about people from other traditions. But when I really started learning about the traditions, I began to see that these stereotypes were really, really uncalled for, that there was so much in common between the traditions. But yes, there are differences, and yes, we need to recognize the differences, but we also need to recognize the points in common and not separate things out. And to really get over all these passed down stereotypes, because I think, you know, in olden times, you know, when Buddhism spread to different countries, different areas, then, you know, they were far away from Buddhists in other places, so they didn't really know what the Buddhists in other places practiced. They never met them. Maybe they heard a little bit, and then they developed an idea. And then also, I think until recently, the Buddhists didn't really meet together so much. And when they did, they all spoke different languages, so they couldn't talk together, you know, directly. So that's something in the last couple of generations that's being overcome. But I remember when I came to Singapore, being faced with some of these traditions, and, you know, one time walking in a park and a man coming up to me, and he said, "And what's my lucky number to win the lottery?" And I said, "I have no idea." "You practice Tibetan Buddhism, don't you?" "Yes, I do." "Well, you practice magic. You should be able to know my lucky number." "Sorry, I don't practice magic." And another time, Akita, when I was living in Hong Kong, one man, you know, offered lunch dana, and during the lunch dana, he said, "Oh, do you practice Vajrayana?" "And, you know, I do some Vajrayana practice." "I said, oh, so you have sex and you drink?" "No." "No, that's not what Vajrayana practice is all about." And I quickly wanted to end the lunch done. So I, you know, I was seeing those kind of things. And then, of course, the Tibetan side, you know, they think that all the Chinese do blank-minded meditation, that they just sit there spaced out meditating on nothingness, which is not true. And then they say the Theravadas are selfish. I remember many years ago, I don't know if you remember this, but it's very clear in my mind. It was many years ago, and one Tibetan group had invited me to come to Singapore. And so when I came, they did not want to reimburse my air ticket. And that put me in a very difficult position because I didn't have very much money. And they had invited me, and, you know, I didn't know what to do. Then, sometimes, one time, and during the visit, I was speaking at the Buddhist library, and so of course I met with Bhante. We've been friends, and I have great regard for him for many, many years. And I was sitting there, and he said, and I don't know how he found out, he said, I heard you had difficulty, you know, with your air ticket, and here we want to help. And he passed me the money for the air ticket. And I'm going, oh yeah, and all these Tibetans say that Theravadas are selfish. You know? This is not holy water, you know, through, yeah? So, you know, we really have to overcome these kind of stereotypes that are completely uncalled for. You know? So, especially on the topic of the four measurables, which is our topic today, the traditions come so closely together in how they teach. When I was reading the Suttimagga by Acharya Kutagosa and his description of the four immeasurables or four Brahman Viharas, it was so close to the way that the Tibetan tradition explained it, and also brought up many points that I hadn't learned in the Tibetan tradition that really helped me to understand the four Brahman Viharas in a much deeper way. And even today, listening to Bhante, I learned a lot, especially when you talked about equanimity, being close to wisdom. Because in preparing for today, I thought I could go through the four measurables like we read here and go through them like that. But I thought, you know, Bhante will probably do that, and there won't be much for me to add. So, I thought I have to approach this in a different way. So, in one of the tantric practices that I do, they have the four immeasurables. And the first three are the same, so I'll go briefly through them. But the last one, anupekka, equanimity, it's presented in a different way than it usually is in the Theravada and the Mahayana traditions. And it has to do with generating wisdom. And I had never heard outside of this, you know, when you said that equanimity, you know, is linked with wisdom, I went, aha, this is how, you know, in this tantric practice, equanimity is linked with wisdom. I'll go into that in a little bit, but it really clicked for me. Okay, now this is how I work, how it works. So, you know, when, as we noticed in the book, if you have the book, I don't know, but in the section on the four immeasurables, there's two presentations. In one of them, it starts out in the order that Bhante gave, with love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And in that way, you know, you progress, starting out with your general attitude towards sentient beings, being one of friendliness, love, wishing them to have happiness. Yeah. And then when they're unhappy, when they're miserable, having compassion for them. Then when they're doing well and progressing well, even better than we are, then instead of getting jealous, having joy and rejoicing together with them. And then equanimity, wishing all beings to have freedom from bias, from attachment, anger, partiality. So that's one sequence. There's another sequence where equanimity comes at the beginning, followed by love and compassion and joy. And then when you first notice this, you go, why is that? You know, why did it go from being the last one to the first one? Well, in one of the ways of generating bodhicitta, is the 7-point instruction on cause and effect to to generate the aspiration for full awakening. And this is founded on first generating equanimity. Yeah? And so when equanimity comes first in the sequence, it's the sequence is a summary of this seven-point instruction on cause and effect. The idea being that before we can have love and compassion and joy for others, we first have to get rid of our attachment and aversion towards them. And as Bhante so aptly remarked, you know, real love has to be without attachment, and that is extremely difficult. Yeah. And so this is why equanimity is put first, because it really gets us to look at our partiality. And how, you know, if somebody's nice to us, if somebody is related to us, yeah, then we're partial. We're attached to them. We favor them more than others. If somebody looks different than we do, is from a different race or religion or ethnic group or age group or health condition group, you know, we find some way that, oh, they're different from me. And so our love, our wish for them to have happiness isn't as intense. We become quite biased. And so as long as we go through our lives with this attachment and this bias, and then also with apathy, you know, towards strangers, who cares? Yes, as he remarked, when there's a tragedy, we step up to help. But aside from that, when you're on the MRT, when you're driving on the highway, do you care about the other people around you? Yeah. No, they're just obstacles that we have to weave around to get where we're going. It's true, isn't it? And if they cut you off on the highway, then they go from being a stranger who you feel apathetic towards, they jump into the enemy camp. Oh, they cut me off. Ooh. Okay. So as long as we jump back and forth between attachment and aversion and apathy, how are we going to love people? How are we going to genuinely wish them to have happiness and the causes of happiness? How are we going to have compassion, wishing them to be free of dukkha and the causes of dukkha? Now, everything's going to be contaminated with our partiality. And our partiality all centers around this false assumption that we're the center of the universe. And we all hold this assumption. Of course, we're too polite to say so. Last night in the talk, I asked people, oh, do you think you're the center of the universe? Everybody goes, no. I said, oh, you're being very polite. Now tell me the truth. Because we all think we're the center of the universe, don't we? And my happiness comes first. Then the people who are nice to me, their happiness comes next. Because they're more worthwhile. Then maybe strangers. I don't care much about strangers. Yeah, okay. You know, if they really need some help. But then people we don't like, do we have love and compassion for them? What do we say about those people? May you get hit by a truck. That's what, when we're being nice. Otherwise, we say, may you go to. No equanimity there, you know? So this process of developing equanimity is quite important. And I think it's important even to be a calm person in our daily life. Not only to mention avoid creating negative karma with other people, but just to be a kind person in our daily life. Because as long as we're always putting people in the category of friend, and the category of enemy, and the category of stranger, having love, having attachment, aversion, and apathy, respectively, for these three groups, then emotionally, we're like yo-yos. Yeah? My teacher used to say that. He said, you guys are like emotional yo-yos. You know yo-yos? Yeah? Up and down, and up and down, and up and down. Oh, I like this person. And then the next day, oh, they didn't call me. I hate this person. They gave me a present. They ignored me. They said they love me. They said they hate me. Yeah? The same person. Yeah? Up and down, up and down. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, look at what being married is like. Well, first of all, the person's a stranger. Yeah? You don't know them. They're like, who are they? You don't care. Then you meet them. They're wonderful. He's so wonderful. I love him. You know, no faults. You don't see any faults at all. The person is perfect. You definitely want them to have happiness and that causes them. Yeah. Then you get married. Oh, they're still so wonderful. Then he starts leaving his dirty clothes on the floor. Yeah. And he doesn't take out the garbage. And he's in a bad mood. You aren't laughing. Yeah. And you go, how come he's like this? Does he think I'm his servant? Oh. He used to say he loved me. Now he just gives me orders. Right? So, you know, emotionally, up, down, up, down, up, down, yeah. When he's nice to you, he's mean to you. Very difficult, isn't it? This is the story of our lives, and we get so emotional about all of this. It really causes us inside a lot of grief, a lot of pain. And we have the same attitude towards parents, too. You know, so much attachment, then, you know, anger when they don't do what we want them to do. Okay? So it's, you know, for me, the key to begin working on this kind of bias that exists in my mind, the key was to realize that I discriminate friend, enemy, and stranger based on the assumption that I'm the center of the universe. And if somebody's nice to me, they must be a good person. And if somebody's mean, they must be a bad person. And if somebody doesn't affect me one way or the other, who cares? And to really look at that attitude within myself and see how completely wrong it is. Why should I favor people who are nice to me when everybody equally wants to be happy and equally wants to be free of suffering? What good reason is there to favor people who boost my ego over people who don't when everybody wants happiness and no one wants suffering? You know, when I really sit and ask myself that question, I cannot find a good reason to favor some people and be against other people. And in fact, sometimes it even seems to me that I should have more love and compassion for the people who harm me than for the people who help me. Because the people who harm have are suffering. They're suffering. That's what makes them do what they're doing. So aren't people who are suffering intensely the objects of our compassion? So when I look closely, you know, I really had to, and I still have to work on it a lot. Believe me, I haven't mastered this. But it, you know, this thing of bias, just, it doesn't make any sense when you really ask yourself for some justification. It doesn't make any sense. And especially in the world political situation that's happening now. You may know there's just been another mass shooting in the U.S., our second one in 1 week, you know, in a public space. And it looks like the FBI is now looking at it as a possible terrorist activity because the wife in it, right before the attack, on her Facebook, pledged allegiance to ISIS. Yeah, so they're looking at it as a terrorist attack. And, you know, then everybody in the country is, oh, these people, they're terrorizing us, they're evil, they're bad, they're this, they're that. You know, and then everybody gets so emotional and gets so filled with anger and hatred. And then the poor refugees that want to come in the country, who are also fleeing ISIS, you know, then we don't want to let these people in, they're going to become terrorists. Everybody starts, you know, thinking in a very biased, confused way. And I look at it, you know, I definitely don't like ISIS, you know. I think that their philosophy is very mixed up and confused. I think their actions, you know, many of the actions are abominable. But I try and separate the people from the actions. Yeah. The actions are abominable. Yeah. The people are suffering. Those are human beings who have the Buddha nature, who have the potential to become fully awakened, but it's totally buried under their ignorance, anger, and attachment. Completely buried. So much so that they think that killing other people is going to bring them happiness. That's real confusion. That's real ignorance and suffering when you think that killing other people is going to bring you happiness. So aren't these the people I should have compassion for? If they're that confused and that suffering? Yeah. That doesn't mean I agree with their actions. Having compassion for somebody does not necessitate agreeing with their actions. I disapprove of their actions and their philosophy. But as individuals, those people, you know, either the ones who did the terrorist attack or the ones who a couple of days ago did the attack in San Bernardino or the one who, you know, 5 days before that did an attack in Colorado Springs. When I think, you know, the one in Colorado Springs, he's still alive, but all those other ones, they're dead. What realm were they? What is their future life? What are they experiencing right now? Right before you die, you kill a lot of people. And your mind is filled with hatred. What are these people experiencing now in their next life? You know, incredible suffering and misery. How can I look and rejoice at people being reborn in the hell realm? Yeah. What kind of kind of person does that make me if I rejoice in somebody else's misery? No matter how horrible their actions were. Yeah. So to see the, you know, you can criticize the actions. The person has the Buddha nature. We don't have to hate the person. Okay? We don't approve of their actions, but we don't have to hate those people. And so similarly in our daily life, you know, people who do things we don't like. Maybe a colleague at work, or the person who cuts you off at the highway. Maybe even your boss. When I come to Singapore, you know the people who people complain the most to me about? Their boss. Every time, you know, Q&A sessions, you know, especially when I'm talking about working with anger, all the questions, my boss! I think, you know, maybe sometimes people need to practice some compassion for their bosses. Hmm? And bosses have some compassion for their employees. Okay? So to really try and remove that bias, you know, so that our mind can remain stable, you know, not so yo-yo. Okay, then I wanted to go into a little bit this, the way that the Four Immeasurables are spoken of in the Yamantaka Savana. So, Yamantaka is one of the very ferocious looking deities, yeah, meditation. So people often look, why do you have these ferocious looking deities, you know? You know, isn't Buddhism supposed to be peaceful? Yeah, what's the story? Like this. Well, the ferocious deities are not ferocious against sentient beings. What they're ferocious or wrathful against is our afflictions. Our mental defilements, especially our ignorance, our anger, our attachment. Okay, so they're not ferocious towards other living beings. They're Buddhas. They're fully compassionate towards other living beings. Okay. So in the, you know, the practice of this one Yamantaka, very ferocious looking deity, there's the Four Immeasurables. And so just the presence of the four Brahma Viharas shows you that, you know, there's no bad will against sentient beings and no, you know, trampling on others or anything. So let me read you the way the four Brahma Viharas are. And the first three are the same, the last one's different. Okay? May all sentient beings have happiness. May all sentient beings be parted from dukkha. May all sentient beings not be separated from happiness. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, unperturbed by preconceptions of the eight worldly concerns and of apprehender and apprehended. So let's just start at the beginning, you know, make a few remarks about the first three. So may all sentient beings have happiness. Usually it says happiness and its causes. This is actually, it's a short phrase, but there's a lot to contemplate here. First, to ask ourselves, what is happiness? What are we exactly wishing for others? That they all have BMWs, and that they can all go on vacation to Bali. What are we wishing when we ask, may they have happiness? Do we only think of happiness in terms of worldly happiness, sense pleasure happiness? What about the happiness that comes from Dharma practice? What about the happiness that comes from having love, compassion, joy, and equanimity? What about the happiness of nirvana? Okay? Which kind of happiness should we be wishing for sentient beings? Is it one, is it the other, or is it both? Okay, this is something to think about. Yeah. I think the ultimate happiness we want to wish for them is may they have the happiness of nirvana. Now, of course, to have the happiness of nirvana, people need to be free of enough suffering in this life so that they have the mental space and the physical conditions to meet the Dharma and practice the Dharma. So we wish them also temporal happiness in this life. And we wish them to have happiness in their next life. But the real happiness we wish is may they be free of all of suffering existence. Okay. And then when we say, may they have happiness and its causes, so not only contemplating what is happiness, but what are the causes of happiness? Are we just wishing, like I said, may everybody have a BMW and enough money to buy it? Is enough money to buy it the cause of happiness? Yeah. Is that what we're wishing? May all sentient beings have tons of money. Is that what we're wishing? Yeah. Are sentient beings necessarily happy when they have money? Yeah, we usually think yes, yes. When you get more money, then you also have a lot of relatives that you didn't know before, and all of a sudden turn up and need a loan. Yeah. When you have a lot of money, now you have all sorts of friends. Yeah. Who aren't genuine friends. So are we really wishing everybody to have a lot of money? So yes, you know, we want, you know, is money the cause of happiness? Have you ever bought something with money or spent the money going on a holiday or something and then been totally miserable? And when you have lots of money, oh my goodness, then you have so many more worries. The stock market went down. Oh no! Well, the stock market went up. Oh, it went down again. Well, they're going to raise the interest rates. That means that my bonds are going to be worth, I don't know if it's more or less, but somehow it changes. Yeah. Then there's so much worry about what's happening to my money. Yeah. Then I have to pay taxes. My tax level just went up. Oh, so much suffering. Yeah. Okay, so to really think, what are the causes of happiness? From a Buddhist viewpoint, what's the cause of happiness? Is it money? What is it?
Virtue.
Yeah? Virtuous actions, abandoning the 10 non-virtues, yeah. Doing the opposite of them, being generous, keeping ethical conduct, practicing fortitude and patience, reaching out to others in kindness. That's the cause of happiness. So when we wish sentient beings to have happiness, consciousness causes, we need to really think about what is happiness, what are we wishing for, and what really is the cause of happiness. Okay? There's a lot to think about in that one sentence. Many sentient beings have happiness in its causes. And so similarly, with compassion, may all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. So again, to think about what is dukkha and what are the causes of dukkha, so that we can really wish, you know, sentient beings to be free of dukkha and its causes. Yeah. And then may all sentient beings never be separated from happiness. This is a way of rejoicing at others' good fortune and avoiding jealousy. Usually when others have good fortune, do we rejoice? Really, when your enemy has good fortune? When somebody else in your company gets the promotion and you don't? Do you go, oh, I'm so happy for them? Or do you go, oh, why did they pass over the promotion to that person? They didn't deserve it. I deserve the promotion. How do you really react? When your ex-boyfriend gets a new girlfriend, do you say, oh good? Even if you were the one who broke up with him? Or if your ex-girlfriend gets a new boyfriend, even though you broke up with her, do you say, oh good? When somebody else, you know, has more success in their dharma practice, do we say, oh good? Or do we say, oh, I want to be like them. Oh, they shouldn't. So learning to rejoice is big protection against bias. Very big protection. Protection against jealousy. So that we can honestly look when somebody has good fortune, either worldly good fortune or dharma good fortune. They, you know, are gaining dharma realizations. Fantastic, I'm so happy for them. But have our heart really mean that. Okay, then the last one on equanimity. Okay. So may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, unperturbed by preconceptions of the eight worldly concerns and of apprehender and apprehended. So unperturbed by the preconceptions of the eight worldly concerns. And do you remember what the eight worldly concerns are? They come, this is spoken of in both the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition. And eight worldly concerns, they come in four pairs. Okay. First pair, being thrilled when we get money and material possessions. And the second half, being dejected when we don't get them, or when they're lost or stolen or broken. Do you have those two of the eight worldly concerns? Are you thrilled when you get possessions and dejected when you don't get them? Yeah. Okay, so we have those two. Does that make you happy in your life? Being an emotional yo-yo, being thrilled and dejected? That make you happy? Oh, I won the lottery! Oh, they're going to tax the whole thing. Not so pleasant. Okay. Second pair of the eight worldly concerns. Being thrilled when we people approve of us and praise us. And then feeling dejected when people disapprove and when they criticize us. Do you have equanimity between praise and criticism? No, we don't, do we? We get praise, we get criticized. Then the third pair is about reputation, being so delighted when we have a good reputation and so dejected when we have a bad one. Yeah, we're like that too, aren't we? Last one, being so overjoyed when we have nice sensory experiences, see good things, hear music we like, pleasant odors, nice food, right? Especially good food, nice tactile sensations. And then being very upset when we're, you know, our five senses are uncomfortable. So these eight we're very involved in our life. Very involved in. What kind of karma do we create with being attached to material possessions, praise, reputation, sense pleasure, and having aversion for loss of material things, for criticism, for notoriety, for displeasure, sense, unpleasant sense sensations? What kind of actions do we do to get the four delightful ones and avoid the four unpleasant ones? Yeah. Do we do actions motivated by love and compassion, generosity? Or do we do actions motivated by greed, anger, and confusion? We create a lot of negative karma in relationship to these eight worldly concerns. And our mind is always going up and down, up and down, up and down. So the wisdom that comes out in equanimity is the wisdom of seeing that there's no sense having so much attachment and dejection. Yeah. That all these things are impermanent. That all these things are dukkha in nature. Yeah. That all these things are not self, they're selfless. When we can have a Dharma understanding of them, then we're free from the preconceptions that of these eight worldly concerns that make us such emotional yo-yos. You getting what I'm saying here? Yeah, so do you see how the wisdom has to come in so that we really understand the three characteristics, and that helps our mind be calm. And then the second part of it here was, you know, may all sentient beings be free from the preconceptions of the eight worldly concerns and of apprehender and apprehended. Okay. Apprehender and apprehended, that means that there's a subject here apprehending an object there. Yeah. Most of our perceptions are very dualistic like that. There's me or my mind on this side being the subject and the object, external, cut off, unrelated, out there. So the apprehender and the apprehended. Okay. In the desire realm, we have so much confusion. We're so attached to the external world, the apprehended objects. Yeah. So we get to have so much I desire, I want, I want, I want, I want, and so much aversion. Get this away from me, I can't stand it. Yeah. So there's no equanimity in our mind when we have apprehender and apprehended, because we're grasping ourself as some kind of true, substantial, inherently existent person, and we're grasping the external objects as also having some nature of their own, being totally objective, unrelated to our consciousness. And so we get in this constant struggle with the external world. I'm the apprehender, and I want nice apprehended objects. So I try and arrange the world to be what I want it to be. But my whole perception is false, because actually, there's not a substantial, inherently existent apprehender or person, or an objective, substantial, inherently existent object out there. Okay. Only when we understand selflessness, only when we understand emptiness, and can abide single-pointedly in the union of shamatha and vipassana on emptiness, do we overcome these preconceptions of apprehender and apprehended as being totally unrelated and inherently existent. So that's a very high realization that we have to develop a lot of wisdom to understand. Okay. When we're able to understand, you know, the real nature of the eight worldly concerns, the real nature of the apprehender and apprehended, then our minds can really abide in equanimity. Yeah. Because we're seeing things as they really are, without all of our false projections on top of them. So that brings a lot of peace in the mind. So this kind of equanimity comes from the wisdom that knows the three characteristics, especially the wisdom that realizes the ultimate nature, that realizes selflessness and emptiness. Okay? So, I think that's enough. Lots to think about here, though, isn't there?
All right, thank you very much, Venerable Chokshin. At this point, we will have a short Q&A. So this is the opportunity to raise any questions that you have about the Dharma sharing that we've had today. And I really appreciate the teachings that have been shared, especially, for example, when Bhante was sharing about how real love is without attachment. I think that's something that really resonates, I think, especially for a lot of us young people, right? And there are a great many answers. And, of course, Venerable Chodron, when you were speaking all about the immeasurables, you know, and when you were talking about separating the people from the emotions, I think that's something that all of us really have to do, but whether or not we can actually do that, that's the main question.
We can do it. We have to practice.
Practice, I think, is especially key. Perhaps I'll just begin with the first question. Yes. Just on a personal basis, I'm starting out as a teacher now, and I think the classroom is one of the best environments for Dharma practice, because I feel like often I have to be like a Yamataka. You know, I have to adopt, you know, that kind of persona almost. You know, if I could ask Venerable, how do we keep a balance between being gentle, you know, being compassionate, and yet also maintaining that sense of discipline that's needed for anything to happen.
Do you want to start with
it?
I think you have to, in your heart, have the love and compassion, and then assess the situation and see which kind of behavior on your part is going to be more effective in dealing with the situation. Yeah. And I think it's always good to start out with a gentle approach. And if that doesn't work, then sometimes you have to be more forceful. But there's a way that even if you have to be more direct like that, that at the same time you are able to convey your affection for the person, your love and compassion for them, that you're not doing it out of anger. And I remember an incident one time when I was traveling and teaching. I stayed in one family's home. It was a Chinese family in the States. And the little boy, they had a little boy, and obviously he had just been disciplined because he came walking across the room crying. And his father, who had disciplined him, came behind him and picked him up and held him. And I thought, wow, you know, that kid knew that he had crossed a boundary, that his behavior was unacceptable, but he also knew that his father loved him. I remember when I was a child, when I behaved unacceptably, I felt like my parents screamed at me and then ignored me. So I felt unloved after that. So it really made an impression on me. Now, if we can, when we have to speak in a straightforward way to somebody, doesn't mean we have to hold them afterwards, but if there's some way to communicate to them, either before or after, that we care about them, that we're not rejecting them, that we're not angry at them, but that the behavior is unacceptable. And I think especially with children in the context of being a teacher, so often with children we say, you're a good boy, you're a good girl, you're a bad boy, you're a bad girl. That gives children no useful information, except that the person in authority likes them or doesn't like them. Aside from that, the child does not understand what they did that their teacher or parent is unhappy with, or what they did that their teacher or parent appreciates. So I think rather than saying you're a good boy or girl, or a bad boy or girl, say, you know, when you hit your little brother, that hurts me because I care for your little brother and I also care about you and I don't want to see you have a bad relationship. Yeah. Or with a child, when they clean up their room, instead of saying, oh, you're a good kid, say, I really appreciate that you cleaned up your room because now I can walk there without tripping. Yeah. So you tell the child the specific action that you either like or don't like.
Thank you, Venerable. Yes. I think that I can definitely apply that in my own teaching practice because there are a great many children out there. You know, I think they would really appreciate having, you know, those actions separated from their personal identity. So with this, do we have any questions from the floor? Please raise your hands. Thank you.
Venerable and Bhante, I'd like to, can you help us bridge the differences between the tradition in two aspects? Number one, I understand that for the Mahayana tradition, Liang, meaning to say it's perpetual, it's still around, and the light, whereas for the Theravada, the Buddha has enlightened, and so it's like a candle whose flame is being ruined, so no longer around. So can you help us reach that? And the second part is for fully enlightened being the Buddha, being rebirth, which is very different between the traditions. Can you help us with that? Thanks.
Your question is a bit tricky question, huh? I have to be very careful because we were discussing about three traditions. So, as you said, there are some differences. But one thing I can say, I am a Theravada monk. Sometimes I don't like to say I am a Theravada monk, because I try to be away from traditions in certain ways. So I don't say Buddha is no more with us, even according to Theravada tradition. The Bodhisattva Gautama attained enlightenment, he became Gautama Buddha, passed away. But it does not mean Buddha is not with us, no more with us. It is a quality. It is the greatest development. And some people ask, they went to the Buddha and asked, what is going to happen to you, if not, what is going to happen to enlightened beings after they passed away? The Buddha answered very carefully. You know, when there is a fire, we say there is a fire. Fire is burning. Maybe due to firewood, due to fuel, and many other things, the fire is going on. But after some time, fire stopped. Then when we ask, where does that fire went? Went to right direction, left direction, up, down, east or west. Can you say where it went? Only thing we can say is all the fuel finished, no more urge to have the fire further. It came to an end. So we travel in this cycle of birth. We are pumping fuel every day, so much. Vehicles need petrol or diesel occasionally, after a certain number of miles running. But we need every moment we are adding fuel. We have attachment, we have anger, we have jealousy, many defilements. We have so much urge to live what we can't do in this life, we want to do in our next life. So, what we eat, not enough, we want to eat better food next life. So, we want very, very refined food in refined restaurants. That's the way we go. So, we have urge to go on and on. But enlightened beings do not have that kind of urge. They have no more defilements. So, they, after they passed away, they come to a kind of cease of all the defilements. But it doesn't mean they are no more. Their achievement is there. Their greatness is there. They have shown great qualities for us to practice. So still they are inspiring us. They can inspire us. So I don't see, even based on Theravada tradition, Buddha is totally gone no more. Buddha is always with us. We can develop all the qualities with the inspiration of the Buddha. So, to me, that the thinking that way is not relevant, not important. For me, Buddha is living forever and forever. But don't misunderstand me, huh? Different way, huh? Thank you.
The way the Sanskrit tradition looks at it is that actually they say, and again, you know, I don't know if I want, I'm just saying this is what they say, I'm not saying this necessarily in my view, but that the Buddha was actually enlightened a long time ago and appeared as a bodhisattva, as an enlightened, unenlightened being in this life in order for his life to be an example to us of how we need to practice. And so even though he was enlightened before, appearing that way and appearing to attain enlightenment again. And the idea behind this is that the mind, you know, is the nature of clarity and awareness. The defilements are not the nature of the mind. So we can eliminate the mental defilements which cause samsara, but the clear and aware nature of consciousness can still continue. That there's nothing that can cease, just the clear and aware nature of the mind. Although there is something that can cease, defilements. So from the viewpoint of the Sanskrit tradition, you know, the Buddha has ceased the defilements, but the consciousness can still continue. And because the Buddha had the greatest compassion for sentient beings and attained all these great powers through the force of his meditation, then he can appear in various forms in later times in order to help and guide the beings. Okay? So that's how we look at it. And I find that quite inspiring, and that makes sense to me. You know, that you can cease the defilements, but it doesn't mean that all consciousness.
Thank you, Venerable. Yes, I think we have time for one last question. It's back.
Venerable Jerome, good to see you in Dongchupia. Can I ask you a question? It's not so related to this topic, but it's happened to me. A few years ago, when I went to Kwantung Rinpoche's teachings, and I brought back the Vajrakilaya Tanka poster, and then I do the Vajrakilaya practice and I went into a trance. The Idam actually came into my body and I performed a Lama dance the next day at my home, in the old house in Pela, and in Kongchok Rinpoche's place. So my question is, what is a Lama dance?
I'm sorry, that's really not a question I can answer. The Lama dances are just a Tibetan cultural thing. They are not always done when people are in trances. And I really can't answer your question, I'm sorry.
Is it a liberation by seeing in the Bado tunnel when you see these Rahu deities manifesting, then you won't be afraid something related to the Bado tunnel or give blessings on the Bima tradition?
You know, the Bardo Toto, that book, the Tibetan book of the dead, is actually a meditation practice that people do after having been initiated by a teacher. And so so those visions that are described in it are part of a particular meditation practice. They don't occur to everybody when they're in the bardo.
The last question is, how to attain Buddha in one lifetime? And should practice.
Yeah, we have to practice very diligently and have a complete conviction in the Buddha's teachings, be able to generate full renunciation from samsara, the loving, compassionate, altruistic intention of bodhicitta, have a full realization of selflessness and emptiness, and then work with the subtle body. So they say that we can attain one enlightenment in one life, but very few people do it. In fact, His Holiness Dalai Lama said that it sounds like propaganda. You know, because you have to do so much purification, so much creation of merit, generate all these realizations fully and completely. Yeah. So to do that means we have to have practiced a lot in our previous lives. Yeah. It means that we've done so much practice in our previous lives that we're almost on the verge of attaining. So it doesn't refer to being some kind of, you know, somebody who doesn't know anything about the Dharma, whose mind is completely polluted, kind of attaining enlightenment in one life. So then people say, well, what about the Lama? He did it. And yes, he did it. But what did he do in all of his previous lifetimes? Yeah, he was a very serious, learned practitioner in many, many previous lifetimes.
Thank you, Venerables. Okay, if you have any other questions, I think we can address those when Venerables will still be around during the signing session. So please feel free to approach Venerables then. I think we have definitely benefited a lot from the session. We will have our dedication of prayers, but perhaps just before that, can we give a round of applause to Bhante Maharaj? Just before we have the dedication, we'd just like to give a note of appreciation to our sponsors and supporters. So we just really like to thank everyone who's made it possible on behalf of Om Tsi Temple. Of course, we'd like to thank Venerables, Bhante Dhammaratana, Venerable Chaudhary, for your very kind sharing, and we've all gained many insights today. And to all our sponsors and donors, because all our copies of the publication have been very kindly sponsored. And we'd like to thank especially Sister Ang Hoi Wei, Brother Lim Yi An, Brother Lai Wei Xiang, Brother William Low, Sister Gillian Low, Brother Lim Kim Tong, and Sister Margaret Wee. And of course, we'd like to thank all volunteers, of course, for Bu Ming Si and for SAS. So, Friends of Sebastian Abbey, we're very happy to have you back again. You were here last year, you were here all the time. And so, thank you so very much. You've been very, very supportive. And to all of you who have attended today's event, thank you all very much, brothers and sisters in the Dharma. We will have, I think, our announcement like, after our dedication prayer. So first, if we may invite Venerable to lead us in our dedication of merits.
I would like Bhante, please.
Whenever you do, that's better.
Suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, or